It's time for Twig this week in Google. Stacey Higginbotham is here. She's got a report from the Intel Developers Forum. That's where she is right now. Kevin Marks joins us from his backyard and from New Jersey. It's Jeff Jarvis. We're going to talk about the latest from Google and give you a demo of the new Google video calling app. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly, CacheFly.com. This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 366, recorded Wednesday, August 17th, 2016. Moving on up. This Week in Google is brought to you by Automatic, the small adapter that turns your clunker into a smarter, connected car. For more information on their brand new Automatic Pro adapter, visit automatic.com/twit and enter the limited time offer code TWIT for $20 off a new device. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Go to ring.com/twig and get $50 off one of their Ring of Security kits, the bundle kit or the pro bundle kit, with their limited time offer. Time for Twig this week in Google. The Googlers are assembling. Jeff Jarvis is here from the City University of New York. He's a professor of journalism at the Townite Center there. Actually, you just started your new semester.
I did. I was brainwashing the incoming class.
I saw you and a picture of them. They all look so smart and young and lively. It's really neat. That's exciting.
It is exciting. Oh, you know, I was thinking you'd be a good teacher.
I'll come and do a talk anytime.
Yeah?
My son is about to graduate from college, and he's a journalism major, and I said, you should go to CUNY.
Yes.
So maybe we can talk about that, too.
Let's do.
I'd love for him to. What he says he wants to do, and I think is probably a smart thing, is get a job first, work for a little while, and then go to graduate school.
We have a fair amount of that.
Yeah.
Why do you need a graduate school degree as a journalist? I've never understood that.
And that's Stacey Higginbotham. She is a journalist.
Challenging me in my entire.
She's a real journalist, unlike me. She's a real journalist. And currently is doing what most real journalists are doing, her own thing at StaceyOnIoT.com. She's currently at the Intel Developers Forum at Moscone Center in San Francisco. Hi, Stacey.
Hi.
And Kevin Marks is joining us. He's had so many jobs, he's decided not to have any more jobs.
Well, I'm trying some new things, but yeah, I'm doing little bits of journalism too now.
Are you?
I'm writing the odd thing, yeah.
Nice. Kevin is a much valued advocate for the open web and the in what he calls the indie web.
Nonetheless, I'm peeved at Kevin right now.
Oh, good. We can have a fight on the show.
Oh, what have I done?
Because I was going to have a joke that normally my face is all pink.
Oh, rats.
Today, mine isn't, and his is. And the joke for me today would have been that you know that Jarvis was named after me, and the next thing named after me was Fuchsia.
I was going to have the new Google operating system.
My face isn't pink, and Kevin's is.
Kevin gets the Fuchsia joke. I don't know where to begin. This is going to be a jam-packed episode. I wouldn't mind starting with you, Stacey. You're at IDF. It's ongoing. In fact, you're missing a session right now that you really probably should be at.
Yeah, how to design my own smart home using Intel's new Joule module.
What is Joule?
It's a new dev board, like Edison, only smaller. It's got, I'm trying to remember if it has a Curie or not. You guys have to forgive me because, oh my God, I've had very little sleep.
You're jet lagged, I'm sure.
I had to get up early this morning and yesterday morning.
Did you fly in? Oh, you didn't fly in this morning. You flew in yesterday.
No, I flew it. No, but I did have to. I had a 7 o'clock call for rehearsals.
Right. You did a session. Was that this morning?
Yes, I interviewed Intel's head of IoT. I'm not going to say the name. We talked about 5G.
Murthy. Was it Murthy? Yes,
it was Murthy.
Nice.
So there you go.
You didn't have to say his full name?
I didn't. He actually had to say mine, which, you know, turnabout's terrible.
We tried. We really, really tried to train you on how to say Murthy's name, but I guess it didn't stick.
You know, the night after, I said it perfectly, like three times, and I was so proud of myself.
You know what, Stacey, is I always say, you don't want to hear me introduce these people. You want to hear them tell you about themselves, which I always do that.
Or sometimes I'll say, if I don't know somebody's name, I'll say, and how do you spell that? Dr. Venkata Renduchintala, also known as Murty. He is the president, client, and Internet of Things businesses and systems architecture group. Wow, what a title.
Yes, he's a former Qualcommer. He had been a Qualcomm forever. So Intel getting him was a big coup. So I would say, actually, if you wanted to pick a big theme for the show, it's that Intel is actually signaling very strongly that it's going to be okay with non-x86 architectures. So the big thing they did was they announced a partnership. Sorry, they announced that they had taken an ARM.
They licensed ARM. Was it architecture license? Which kind of license is it?
I don't think it was an architecture license. Okay. I was trying to find someone who had said that, and I could not. So I can't tell you if it's architecture or not, but they're using it to manufacture ARM-based chips. And so this is big for two reasons. One, they have billions of dollars invested in their fabrication plants, and they have to keep those things running all the time. It costs them huge amounts of money. This gets them manufacturing the chips at the edge, basically. So they may have not won on mobile, but they're like, we'll just make them instead. So
it's a really interesting strategy because, of course, traditionally you'd think of ARM and Intel at odds, that they're competing architectures. But, of course, Intel has a lot of fabs. They have a 10-nanometer process, and it makes perfect sense. If you can't beat them, join them. They're licensed the architecture. No, ARM doesn't make its own chips. It licenses it to other manufacturers. Why shouldn't Intel manufacture ARM processors like Samsung and LG and everybody else and Qualcomm?
And the cool thing, what you'll see, my hunch is you'll see a company like Apple, because Intel has the most advanced manufacturing, take a look at this and say, and start moving their manufacturing from like Samsung, maybe not TSMC, over for a variety of reasons.
Interesting. Yeah. TSMC, the Taiwan Silicon Manufacturing Company, looks like it's going to have an exclusive this time around on the new iPhone.
Makes sense.
For last year, iPhone, and there was this whole battle going on with, whose chips are better? Apple was sourcing chips from TSMC, and was it Samsung was the other source?
Samsung. They had two different, this is super nerdy, they were manufacturing using two different processes. So, and I can't remember who was doing which one, but one was like a FinFET process.
Right.
And
then there were people were going back and forth with benchmarks. Oh, you want the TSMC chip? And it was crazy. You can't tell a difference. But I think it's interesting. I think Apple doesn't want to buy anything from Samsung at all.
Right.
And so it makes sense. At the same time, you don't want to single source something that's that important. If TSMC has a fire and can't build any chips, you're in trouble. So I don't think
everyone would be in trouble.
Well, they wouldn't be alone. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I thought that was probably the biggest story was that Intel's going to license ARM and start manufacturing ARM chips.
And then, they showed off this little Project Euclid, which is this little candy bar-sized device. I should have tried to steal one from the demos.
What happened to your klepto tendencies?
I know. Well, they guard these things pretty well. Yeah. I gotta be honest.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is for robotics. And this is cool because it has a camera with some computer vision. It has sensors on it, and the idea is it supports two different robotics frameworks, Turtlebot and Arduino. And you can use it for like a really high-end fancy robot or like a pretty chill low-key robot, and you can build these apps like a Follow Me app in like 20 seconds. They have this great GUI interface, like kind of combined with like an IDE, and you just are like, I want to turn on this type of intelligence and this sensor and this one, and you check off these boxes, and then it basically, like, I guess it flashes it to the Euclid and you stick it on your robot and it happens. I know.
First quarter 2017.
And we have no word on pricing. I was like, is it $100? Like more, less? He's like, I'm not telling you.
Intel's RealSense technology is used in some computers. And if you go to see a 49ers game, and I'm sure it's true if you go see a Cowboys game, or a Jets game or a Giants game, or they have like this kind of, you know, medieval Renaissance fair outside the front. And one of the booths is the Intel RealSense booth, and it's kind of cool because it'll take a picture of you and face paint you with, you know, the 49er colors or whatever in real time, kind of like Masquerade does or the Snapchat things. But that's the kind of technology that's in here.
And I think they have that here. They had like a get your picture or portrait yes. painted like an Italian masterpiece.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which same, very applicable.
Same,
that is.
Same booth.
Same booth.
Repurposed. Instead of yellow and gold, they have or silver and black or whatever. They have something else. I'm also interested, and I know you. It's probably not up your alley because it's. I don't know if this. Well, might have an impact in IoT devices. It's something they're calling CrossPoint. This is going to be a joint venture with Crucial, Micron, that makes the Crucial thing, and it's a new kind of memory that crosses the line between DRAM, traditional RAM. And storage, NAND storage, it's a right. 1,000 times faster than traditional NAND drives. It's not quite as fast as RAM, but it's fast enough to be used in lieu of RAM. So imagine instead of the traditional setup on a PC where you have storage that loads stuff into RAM that the CPU gets access to, and there's bottlenecks all along the way, instead you have a huge chunk of cross-point memory that might be terabytes that is used as RAM as well. And it does make sense in IoT where speed is not critical. It would greatly simplify IoT devices because you don't have to have discrete RAM and storage. It can all be one thing.
Now, Intel actually announced this. Intel and Micron announced this last year.
Right.
Believe it or not. I think they are announcing. Did they announce a ship date? Is that what
this year.
Is the okay.
Fall.
And
they were.
And the other thing is it's both 1,000 times faster and it can last through 1,000 times more data writes, which
right.
is interesting when you're kind of like upgrading algorithms and things like that for like artificial intelligence. But it's an entirely – it's a new type of memory. So, yes, like you said. And this has been like a 10-year effort. And, again, this is why Intel like – becoming a manufacturer is really interesting because they've spent a lot of money and effort thinking about like new ways to just build chips. And 3D XPoint is a new way to build memory.
Yeah.
So I think this is cool. I mean, I will always think semiconductor manufacturing is cool because I'm a big nerd.
Well, and I think, Kevin, you probably can weigh in on this, but this is the first fundamental architecture change in how computers work since – you know, Alan Turing conceived of a Turing machine. I mean, the idea of not having separate RAM, separate memory, and separate storage, but of combining the two is amazing.
Well, I mean, the Turing's abstraction didn't really
he didn't mention storage and RAM. All right.
His was an imaginary tape.
But when we started building them,
yeah,
that's what we did.
It's more of a challenge to the Voigt-Neumann architecture where there's a
right.
notion of
yes.
a CPU that has a small number of registers and then successive
right.
layers of slower storage outside
that's
it.
Right.
And, you know, so if you actually look at it, there's a sort of hierarchy of speed between the different layers of the stack. And this is blurring a couple of the layers. Because in a sense, you know, SSDs are kind of, you know, they're kind of RAM anyway. They're treating memory as if it was storage.
Yeah, so they're just slow RAM. They're random access, though.
Yeah, the random yeah. access. You don't have the same performance penalty of seeking that you do with
right.
spinning metal disks and things. But it's still, you know, it's a layer of like, is it in the CPU? Is it on the chip? Is there a cache there? Is the cache there? And as stuff fans out, and a lot of performance work is spent, you know, working on when things are moving from one cache to another in the stack. So, you know. I'm not sure how big a difference it makes to actual sort of engineering designs because a lot of engineering is spent thinking about those transitions already.
Here's why I'm thrilled to see it. It's just I was a little worried about Intel, to be frank, and it's nice to see that they have been innovating. This reminds me a little bit of IBM in the day where they really have deep R&D labs and they have some really interesting stuff they're coming up with. Stacey, what is the sense at the conference? Are people excited about these new technologies?
Most people are here kind of sad because they feel like none of these things are ready to take off in a sense that would mitigate some of the loss of the PC business, for example.
Right.
Or not loss, but...
Well, so no, I mean, you're right. I mean, it's been hurting Intel badly, right?
So, I do think that we're going to see... I don't know if Intel will be as big as it ever was, but I don't think it's going to go away. And they have... It'll be really interesting to see the fights that develop because Intel's actually coming after almost everyone. Like, they're like, okay, fine, we don't want anything at the edge, but we're coming after the gateway boxes. We're coming after the cellular RAN business. That's radio access networks. We're coming after, like, the cellular equipment business in the core of the network. And then, again, where they've always been strong in the data center and in the cloud. But they are coming after with, like, the FPGAs and the Nervana buy. They're, like... Haha, and NVIDIA, we're coming after you. They had Intel and NVIDIA had this little spat over benchmarking in the last couple of days.
Yeah. We'll see about that one.
Yeah, I'm like, eh.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd go head to head with NVIDIA at this point. So anything else? Making ARM chips is kind of amazing. This cross-point technology is very interesting, and the fact that it's so close. What else?
I'm trying to think of the cool stuff that I have seen some fun things. I've been hanging around in the maker area, so I saw like toys battle. I mean, some of this is just stuff you see at every kind of maker fair kind of conference. So I'm trying to think of
that RealSense thing. Seems really cool. Did anybody build anything with that?
There's some robots. There's actually a robot. There's a demo here of a robot inventory management system. I know you guys are like, oh my god, kill me. I would have built BattleBots, but.
No, Amazon needs these, I'm sure.
Yes, it's this robot that goes zooming along your shelves and it scans to see what you're missing, what you have. It saves like a lot of work.
Yeah. If Walmart's going to compete with Amazon, which they apparently want to do, they're going to need some way to make it possible to use their stores as fulfillment centers or something. So maybe this is what that's aimed at. I don't know.
There you go.
So
go ahead. I was going to say, Intel finally delivered on their silicon photonics.
What's that?
I mean, silicon photonics is light waves on a chip instead of moving data with light instead of
electricity.
Electrons.
Wow.
So they had missed a couple deadlines, but finally today they showed it, and it's a little laser integrated onto a chip, and it's like zoop, zoop, and things go really fast.
Wow.
That was my scientific explanation.
Here's a scientific explanation on the relative speeds of cross-point versus hard drives. In the time it takes a hard drive, if a storage device were a runner, to sprint the length of a basketball court, NAND memory, solid-state drives, could run a marathon. And X-point technology could circle the globe. Do you hate this?
It's so marketing.
But I like it. Maybe it's because I kind of spent a lot of my time trying to explain stuff to real
people. How many chips do you pile upon each other
to get to the
moon?
They're
going to sell that would get you to the moon.
Yeah. Well, that is one of the things that's interesting, actually, about cross-point technology is it's a lot more dense than DRAM, 8 to 10 times more dense, because they're doing this kind of stacked layers of memory. So you're going to get a lot of storage in a very small space.
And stacking is the new way to get around Moore's Law. Maybe we need a stacking law.
Oh, interesting.
Right. Oh, really? Oh.
Instead of trying to increase density in two dimensions, they're putting more layers on top of each other and cross-connecting them. Yeah.
Right.
I think this is really exciting. I hope this isn't pie in the sky. I hope it's not like the equivalent of nuclear fusion. It seems to me this could completely change computing. And IoT, big time, because this something that can last a really long time, use very little battery, and is cheap and not complex to make is exactly what you need for IoT.
I don't know that it's not complex to make.
Well, I'm sure it is initially, and it's not cheap initially. But I'm assuming Moore's new law will lower the price of this.
Krasanich's law?
Krasanich's law.
I'm trying to think of the CEO of Micron.
Murthy's law.
Some unholy...
You had Murphy's law. Now you have Murthy's law.
Yeah.
You just tell him, make a law. It doesn't matter what it is. It'll catch on. So we're going to take a break, but I'm curious. I want you to, Jeff, explain why journalism school. Because
you're letting me off the hook.
I let you off the hook, but I'm going to put you back on that hook. in just a second, especially since my son says, maybe I will go to a J school. Our show today brought to you by the new automatic. Did you have one there? Did you see it, Stacey?
I haven't seen the new one. I've seen them before and played with them.
Well, I love the old automatic. I have them in all my cars. The idea of the automatic, of course, is it uses the OBD2 port in your car, which every car built since 1996, even my Tesla, has. It's right under the steering wheel. You'll see it there. You connect the OBD2 device, the automatic, onto that, and pair it with your phone by Bluetooth. And now your car is part of your quantified life. It's, it's the obvious thing. When a check engine light comes on, you can see what's going on. And actually, the app is very cool because it'll also tell you the nearest repair shop. But it does a whole lot more. It'll keep track of, for instance, it'll pair gas usage, accelerator usage, brake usage, and put it all together in a trip, a little trip packet that I have with If This and That, uploading to my Evernote. So every time I take a trip in my car, I know exactly how much it costs, how many times I brake hard, how many times I went accelerated too fast, exactly a map of my trip. It's really awesome. This is even better. The new, get ready, Automatic Pro is here. What are they adding? What could you possibly add to something that's so perfect? 3G.
Dun, dun, dun.
Unlimited 3G with no subscription.
What?
Wow. Oh, it's built into the price of the automatic?
So I guess it's like the Kindle Whisper thing, right? When the Amazon was doing that. So the adapter plugs in. Your driving data is relayed over 3G. You could track everything in your Automatic Pro app. And because it's on 3G, you could do crash alerts, trained responders. This is like, like OnStar or something, ready 24/7. Will contact you and emergency services and loved ones if there's a serious accident. What? This is so cool. You'll know where your car is all the time. Now, this is something I love about the Tesla app is I could see a map when Lisa takes my car of where she is. Now the automatic will do that too. It makes your car so smart, gives you so much information about what's going on in your car. Literally a map of where your car is right now. There are lots of apps too. If you've got a teen driver, you can use the Automatic Pro or the regular automatic to help them be better drivers. Even on Android, turn off texting during their trip. You can see all the apps that it pairs with your Nest. It'll turn on the thermostat when you're on your way home. If This Then That, you can ask your Amazon Echo how much gas is left in the car. If you track business expenses, you can use Concur, Expensify, FreshBooks. They all interface to the automatic, so you can keep track of business mileage automatically. You can even tie it to your jawbone up. I'm not sure how that would work. You walk 2 miles, but you drove 43. I don't know. Really neat stuff. So are you interested? Go to automatic.com/twit for more information. The Automatic Pro, now you'd expect this to cost a lot more. The base automatic, $99.95. The Automatic Pro, $129.95. That's all. And when you use our exclusive offer code TWIT, you'll save $20. That pretty much brings it down to the original price. Yeah. So you're getting all that extra functionality basically for free. automatic.com/twit. Time for your new automatic. I am so excited about this. I really am. And you knew about it already. They must have announced it earlier.
They announced it today. Another note about this, like from a news, not necessarily a selling on people perspective, but Automatic is funded in part by USAA, the insurance company.
Yes.
And having the 3G capability is essential for being used for any sort of insurance efforts. So my hunch is we'll see this soon.
Well, I'm a USAA insurance customer. I have a USAA investment and banking account too. So that's great. Yeah, I knew they were an investor, but that's really good. Automatic, just like it sounds, automatic.com/twit. Find out about the new Automatic Pro. That is really, really awesome. Really, really awesome. All right, back we come to This Week in Google. Anything else before we move on from the Intel Developers Forum, Stacey?
If you see anything happening behind me, let me know.
Oh, somebody sneaking up behind you? She's in the press room right now.
I am. You can tell because no one here is well dressed.
Except the waiter is walking by in tuxedos.
If they had only gone to J school, they'd be well dressed, right, Jeff Jarvis?
Yeah, you bet. Better employed. So I got an undergrad degree at Northwestern. I did not get a graduate degree. I got jobs. A couple things. In my day, young children, in my day, you know, the way you worked up was I went to work for the Burlington and Iowa Hawkeye and the Detroit Free Press, and I worked up and up and up and up. Chicago Tribune, San Francisco Examiner, Time Inc. And that's how you got the added training. That doesn't exist anymore. That path simply doesn't exist. One. Two, a lot of our students, our median age is 26, 27. A lot of our students are career changers. So they're coming to graduate school in journalism to start in journalism, which makes a great deal of sense. If you have an undergrad degree in journalism, what we're finding is people are coming back even later in their career, some right out of college, but some later because they want to considerably advance their skills.
You know, that's what I told Henry to do. I said, get some real-world experience. He wants to work for Vice this summer as an internship, something like that. I said, that's great. I think he wants to be more in production. I said, that's not less of a writer, more of, you know, video. He looks at me and he says, boy, what you got is an easy job, so I want to do that. And I think he kind of fantasizes about taking Twit over in a couple of years.
Well, it's kind of neat to train him. If you look at some of the families that have trained their own heirs, like the Newhouses in advance and so on, the Salzburgers.
The Murdochs.
The
Grahams.
They get certain jobs as they go and learn the way up. And I'm happy if you ever want me to talk to Henry about journalism careers. I'd really be more than happy to sit down with him.
I told him all about you, and I said, I told him all about Jake, too. And I said, Jeff's a great guy, and he will be a very good mentor for you. The Bradleys.
I don't know if I answered Stacey or not, but.
You have yet to convince me. I'm sorry.
Did you get a journalism degree, Stacey?
I did. I have a BJ from the University of Austin.
Nice.
Or University of Texas at Austin.
Yeah.
But the idea of going back to school in journalism seems strange.
Well, I think if you were lucky enough to have somebody like Jeff as a professor, that would change the equation. Because, of course, journalism is changing rapidly, and probably a lot of journalism schools are trying to figure it out. I have no idea.
That's true.
I mean, they teach you here's how you write a lead. Here's how you file your copy. But I think when you have somebody like Jeff, who has definitely got his finger on the pulse of what's happening and what's changing.
It's also, if you're someone like Stacey, in all sincerity, you're teaching yourself, you're working at places where you're inventing businesses, inventing new things. A lot of people who go out of J school land in newspapers that aren't changing. And the only way they can get these new skills, and they're not training anybody.
Right.
They're not updating your skills at all. So the only way they're going to get to learn about new stuff is to go to school. Could you teach it all yourself? Yeah, you could, but you're busy as hell, forced to write 87 blog posts a day. Right. It's a way you break out and try to move up in the world. And then also these days, when I brainwashed the class today, I took them through all kinds of new jobs that didn't exist 5 years ago. Product development is a huge new field. Audience development, though I hate the title, is important. Social media, web video, data journalism. These are all specialties where we've got to do a better job, too, of teaching greater specialty. Giving every student, it's what I call a skills transcript, that every student has to have a certain level of skills across a wide range of things now. Every student has to know social media and data and obviously the web and web video and so on. But then they need, in our research with employers, they need what we call superpowers. You need at least one. You need to be really good at all of that, and plus knowing stories and knowing how to do facts and all that. But you also might need to be a specialist in audience development or in social media or in web video so that you have that extra value in getting a job. And so they can come and they can concentrate enough or become a documentary filmmaker or whatever the hell they want.
I would really love to learn data journalism if I were going back to school right now. I think that's fascinating.
There's a program.
It's the new kind of investigative reporting.
Yes.
It is.
There's a San Marcos, Texas State University, which is not like
LBJ's home school.
Yes. So they actually have a data journalism master's program, and I've actually thought about. I'm like,
wouldn't you love that? See, now that we're all working, it seems like such a luxury to be able to take a year or two and, yeah. and go to yes. school would be an incredible luxury.
Yes. I'm like, can I just take some of these classes every now and then and work on it while I actually do my job? So
You might be able to.
No, they're actually, I've talked to them before. Yeah. We did, I've done some projects with local journalists down here, and they're like, yes, you should come. So one day.
Yeah, because that's the chance to go through stats and data right. and visualization and all that, too. And there's great programs there. Plus, we have an entrepreneurial program where you learn to start a business and do so. The new social journalism program where we kind of reinvent journalism. I'm working on a new degree right now. So, if I thought that I were leading students astray, I'd obviously be a horrible fraud. But one thing I haven't learned in journalism school is how to adjust this camera.
You should teach that. Actually, you can also use big data journalism and investigative journalism for advocacy purposes. I was just reading about Mr. Trump's new campaign manager, who is former, was he executive editor or chairman of Breitbart?
Chairman of Breitbart, yeah.
And he is obviously a smart fellow because besides doing the advocacy blogging at Breitbart, which is very, you know, very clearly, aimed at promoting an agenda, he also created a foundation to spent money on trying to get deep data information that they could then go to mainstream press like the New York Times with and say, look, you know, we've dug up the data here. And that wins them over in a way that the advocacy does not. Steve Bannon is his name. And
yeah, Jay Rosen wrote it. I mean, I'm sorry, not Jay Rosen. He linked to something today. Ben Smith, the editor of BuzzFeed, I'm putting it in the feed right now, wrote a good piece today, arguing that this is the final merger of media and campaigns and politics.
Interesting. But you know what? That happened a long time ago with Karl Rove and Roger Ailes. And, you know, I mean, I remember when Nixon used admin, it was like, oh, my God, what a revolution. And yeah. Now it's like that's clearly how you have to win a campaign. I don't know. We got a little sidetracked on the on the journalism.
Stacey's fault. Blame Stacey.
No, you know what? Right. I love talking about this stuff.
Did you see the Mother Jones thing today?
Oh, about the prisons and the cost of reporting the story?
Yeah, that was interesting. So they wrote up. I put it in the chat room, but they wrote a piece about, you know, that they did that great investigative work on private prisons. And it basically was like an 18-month journalism project. And they say it cost them about $350,000 to do, and they got about $5,000 in advertising on it despite getting a million views. Oh. And so they're saying, oh. You know, we want to keep doing this, and the way we're going to keep doing this is if you pay us to keep doing it. So please sign up for subscriptions to us at $15 a month and support us doing this kind of work. So they're basically going for the NPR model. Which is, you know,
which The Guardian is doing as well. Kath Viner, the editor of The Guardian, wrote a wonderful piece basically saying, here's why you need us. And right. Their membership plan has kind of shifted toward patronage. And I think there isn't enough patronage to support all the journalism in the world, but the fine journalism like Mother Jones and The Guardian. And when I pay the New York Times, I'm paying them not to get access to content. I'm paying them out of patronage, not out of support.
No, exactly.
Right. And yet, didn't the Wall Street Journal just the other day, and I saw you gloating about this on Facebook, announced...
No, I said I wasn't gloating. Whereby I was gloating.
Gloat, not... Hashtag gloat, not gloating.
It was a humble gloat.
Humble gloat. Has started to restructure its paywall.
Few bricks out of the wall there.
Yeah, giving people more ways to read without
days passes
paying.
And social links and that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's and there was also a piece.
Does that mean that their paywall isn't working for them? Because if it doesn't work for the Wall Street Journal, it won't work for anybody.
It means that there are things they can't do, right? The reason they had to buy MarketWatch way back in the day was to get more reach so they could get that kind of advertising. They want to get more conversion and more sampling, so they need to get more people in. They want to reduce the cost of their subscriber acquisition cost, whether you're a magazine or a website, you have to pay to market. So if people will sample your content, that's a hell of a lot more efficient. So in a sense, giving up some money in the paywall for day passes or sampling or social links is a way to get people in as marketing. There was another piece just out this week that said that basically apart from the New York Times and the Journal et al., paywalls are not working for newspapers.
And yeah, that was tech dirt, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not surprised. I mean, there is the counterexample of people like, I think that's working, Jessica Lesson and Ben Thompson at Stratechery, Jessica Lesson at
very high level.
Where, yeah, but I mean, well, okay, admittedly, and yeah. She's $400 a year and doesn't need more than maybe a few thousand subscribers for it to be, you know, sensible and profitable.
She could stand a few more bricks out of the wall because I haven't paid the $400 for Jet.
That's the problem. And that's why you take the bricks out of the wall. There's a promotional value. And that's what Ben Thompson does. He gives away a considerable number of one article a week, and then you pay and you get more. And you
doesn't he also have a windowing strategy or where you get them later?
I don't know if he does. I think Philip Elmer DeWitt that we were talking to.
Oh, that's who. Okay, yes, sorry.
His Apple 2.0 blog. Philip, of course, was at Fortune, as were you, I know, and left not so long ago to create a blog, and that's exactly what he does. It's free to read after a few days. So, we need all these different – this is what happened with podcasting. We had to figure out all these different ways to monetize it to figure out which ones – work. The nice thing about our advantage in podcasting is we can do ads that are not completely annoying and they don't carry malware and they, I think we can do ads that serve our audience, to some degree as well as the content.
But they're less trackable.
Yeah. And so far, that doesn't matter so much. What it does to our advertisers, what it does mean is that advertisers are going to, it may mean we'll never get out from under direct response ads. That, you know, we won't be able to get much brand advertising, some say. I disagree. I think brands really can't track TV ads either. They're used to doing research and figuring out whether the ads are working. I don't think trackable. You can track a banner ad really well, right? Does that help them be more effective? I don't think so.
Yeah, no. And neither native advertising. How trackable is that?
You know, right.
The holy grail is to get from ad to intent, ad to purchase. Obviously,
right. I always say that's
extremely hard.
If we don't produce a return on investment for our advertisers, they shouldn't buy ads with us.
Right.
And ultimately ultimately that's the final metric it's the only metric that matters. And they
did
just
you
have
ever
to
consider Leo opening up a store? I remember back in the days of the Trio blog. And it was a great blog, and it was amazing there was a blog about one product. But I was, a fanatic Trio user in the day.
So you
That's
read
how
it.
How old I am, children.
Yeah.
And he started opening up a store selling accessories, cases and all that stuff. And that became the core of the business. And for the Trio and then a few of the follow-on things, I don't know what happened to him. But the notion of commerce, have you ever thought of just using Best Buy, Amazon APIs, and
create
a commerce opportunity?
We do that. I think a couple of things. We used to have I think we might still have a page that says, not only here are our sponsors, but if you want to support us, buy this through this Amazon link.
Oh, okay.
We used to have a tip, like a product picks page. I don't think we ever brought that back, but eventually we could. It's some income. It's not enough. It's not a huge amount of income, especially when you have to hire somebody to do it.
Yeah, that's true.
We're actually very happy with our kind of simple model.
You're driving a Tesla from it.
It works.
Yeah, don't mess with it. Why bring? I mean, I'm serious. Like, why bring? You don't have to take over the world.
No, in fact, that's the other thing. At some point, any entrepreneur has to grapple with the idea: is this a lifestyle business? Is this an Uber unicorn, or is it something in between? And I think we made this something in between, which is. We want to be. We're not trying to get bigger, just better. And our revenue's gone up steadily every year. We make a decent amount of money now. So, why break it? Not that I want to talk about myself. Let's talk about Duo.
Or let's talk on Duo.
You want to talk on Duo? So it came out today. I'm waiting for a couple of days ago. I'm waiting for Allo. When's Allo coming out?
I'm too. Yeah. If you go to the Play Store. You can say,
yeah, I'm registered for it. It'll
come up. Yeah, I saw that. That was weird. Yeah, when I installed Duo, it said, people also installed Allo. I was like, no, they didn't. This is a scam.
No, but I had registered somehow. I guess I went to a website. So when I went to the Play Store before either came out, it said registered. And then automatically I got a notification when Duo came out. It said, okay, you can download it now. I presume I'll get the same thing with Allo.
I presume so.
These were both announced at the Google I/O Developers Conference. Duo is Google's FaceTime, basically. Except unlike FaceTime, it's completely cross-platform. It's based on an open standard as well, WebRTC. Right? This is just a WebRTC client, Kevin, right?
I think so, yeah. I mean,
which is easy to do. It kind of begs the question, why did it take them so long to get this out?
Well, it can't just be WebRTC on iOS because they don't actually have WebRTC on iOS.
So iOS was the hang.
Yeah, so there's no WebRTC in Safari, and you can't run another browser runtime. So you've got to build it
right now. That's probably what takes, because you could crank this out pretty quickly using a web view, right? Anyway, it is point to point only. A couple of interesting things people noticed. For instance, you do not need a Google account when you put it on a phone. You'll tie it to your phone's number. Some people complain, saying, "Well, I don't want to have it a different one on all my different devices." Well, no, but that's the point. Is this is like your phone device? It's like making a phone call. So I'll call you, Jeff, so we can see. It's a little dark in here. By the way, because I had talked to Jeff before, his icon was right there on the front screen. And this is kind of fun. Watch, I tap my picture, and I'm full screen, and then he's full screen. I don't know what that's good for.
Hey, well, let me turn the volume down all the way.
I didn't even know could change the volume. It's very simple. The point is, there's very few controls. You could flip the camera from front to back and back to front. I don't know what else you can do with it. We can talk. We'll have a nice conversation. I guess one of the best things is iOS and Android. It is not available there. Now I'm seeing Jeff's picture. It is not available for desktop. You can't. There are WebRTC clients, but they don't interoperate with this. iOS and Android only. Also, and this is Florence Ion's article going through some of the points, the knock knock. So when I called you, Jeff, well, here, let me hang up and you can call me, Jeff.
Okay, fine.
All right. So show my phone if you would, Josh. So the knock knock thing, they talked about this at Google I/O. When he starts to call me, I'll immediately get a live image of Jeff. And so I can decide whether to pick up based on, I can see him. And I still haven't answered the call yet. Boy, I wish you could see it. I wish it were brighter. You know, let me turn this up all the way. Let me turn this up. There we go. Turn off auto. Turn it up all the way. All right, now, call me again, Jeff. It hung up on you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, let's check it. Okay, ready?
It gave up. See, now you can see it, right? So, that, by the way, was from the desktop.
Please, Leo,
I haven't answered yet.
Please answer my call. Please.
I don't get audio, I think. And then I swipe up.
I'm feeling very lonely.
And he goes from kind of this dim black and white guy to colorful.
To the pink guy.
Pink guy, yeah. Picture's good, right? Look how good the picture is. I think it works great. You can't do sideways though, right? Or can you? What happens if I turn it sideways? Do you?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So we can. Yeah. So yeah. We could use this, I guess, on the show, except we can't get rid of these controls, but, or maybe we can. I haven't played with it that much.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. So I'm going to be obnoxious. Now I'm going to try to force you to use this for me in the show. Yes.
We could.
next time in a hotel.
I would. You know what? It would probably work better, wouldn't it?
So does it work on tablets or only on phones?
It was designed for phones, they said, but I think it works on tablets.
I think you could put it on your iOS device if you had a Google Voice number, for instance, and you could get, because the way you verify the number is it sends a text. If you are on the same phone, it will auto enter the text, right? But I noticed that if it doesn't do that, yeah, I think I put it on my iPad actually. You could enter the text in by hand, so I think you can use it on a tablet.
Quality looks good.
Yeah. Quality looks great. Actually, I'm kind of blown away by the quality. It's better than...
Yeah.
We should probably start using it. Actually, we can't use this. You know why
we can't get it off the phone.
Yeah. We'd have to hook a phone up to our system. Skyposaurus is Windows machines.
Well, you could Chromecast it.
I could Chromecast it.
That, you're Chromecasting into something that...
That wouldn't hurt the latency at all, would it? No, it doesn't. Wow. You'd have to Chromecast the whole thing. It doesn't have many controls. I mean, if there's a negative, it's not very fancy. It's a video only. It doesn't work with any other Google product, including Allo. You already have video calling, probably on Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp Messenger and Skype, and so do many of the people you converse with. So that's probably the biggest knock, and it's true of any of them, is you have to have somebody that's using it on your phone book. Now, the way we did this is Jeff's in my contacts list. So he showed up in my Allo contacts once he, your Duo contacts, once he installed Duo. So that's pretty transparent. You just have to get everybody you know to install
Duo. So market positioning, what's the advantage of Duo versus everything else? Just cross-platform?
I don't know. Kevin, why is Google doing this?
Who knows? You know, they showed it off at I.O. and they said the point of this is that it's really simple. That was their pitch as far as I could tell. It's like
true.
It's one button.
It is.
I mean, the thing is that video calling is like, it's not magic anymore. It's
right.
Something anyone
it's
can
ubiquitous.
Do.
It's ubiquitous. It's the Netflix of right. your phone.
You know, like five years ago when we were playing around with this, it was hard. You know, actually 10 years ago we were playing around with this, it was computers only. But the point is, it's now table stakes. All the things can do video chat, and so I think they've just tried to wrap this up in the simplest possible thing. They've charged the phone number so that it just feels like I've made a video call, and then that's the thing that you can work for Android and iOS. I mean, the thing is, you could do this with Hangouts already. That's the bit that's slightly weird.
But Hangouts are always so quirky.
Well, Hangouts always has, like, the app has accreted so much stuff that it's quite hard to work out what you're doing with it. Right. So they announced this week that they're dropping Hangouts on Air as well. So mm-hmm. they may be slimming this down a bit and making it less of a sort of Swiss Army knife thing. But, you know, there was also, like, links in with Google Plus and all sorts of, like, other random bits and pieces that join together. So if they're actually going to streamline these products a bit, that would be good. But they don't seem to be doing this. They seem to be adding more new ones rather than saying, oh, of the six chat apps we've got, let's consolidate them and make them coherent. I've still got six ways of getting text messages on my phone, three of them controlled by Google, and it's confusing as anything. So it's a single function thing. It makes a bit more sense as that, but I'm slightly puzzled by it, and I'm not sure, you know, how I'd use it.
I'm
probably more likely to use Facebook Messenger's video chat because it's in the client that I'm actually talking to people on.
Yeah, and so I also think nobody wants to make video calls.
No, that's not true. Okay, so my daughter, who's 9, and kids who are younger, that's what they expect.
They do? Interesting. Okay.
So, like, if I call her and I call her on the phone, she actually holds the phone in front of her. She does. This is how she talks on the phone, no matter what.
Really?
Right.
So
I thought that was the Kim Kardashian thing.
Let me ask you this.
Right, but she's too young.
But there is that as well. There is the talking to your phone on speakerphone is a thing that's a reality TV trope, but people have picked up on it.
Yeah.
Is that what that is? So when people are walking down the street talking like this?
Yeah.
The equivalent of the old French cigarette thing.
Yeah. Well, I think it did start with the Kardashians because, of course, in order to video people having phone calls, you have to do that.
So obnoxious.
It's really obnoxious, it's interesting how that's become au courant. And it is. It's the worst thing ever. You can hear the call. It's just so annoying. It's just
terrible. And it just looks ridiculous. It
should be banned.
So mine is doing it looking for a person's face. She's not doing it because...
No, she's doing it. It makes more sense.
That's why I'm interested, because she's a new generation and she is doing it. So that's
Like my friend who's got a 4-year-old, he travels like 200 and something odd days a year, and his daughter doesn't even know what a phone call is. A phone call is FaceTime for them.
Right.
So like when she saw me, she was over at our house and she saw me talking on my phone. She's like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "Oh, I'm talking on the phone." She's like, "They can't see you." And I was like, "Well, yeah." And she's like, "How are you talking on the phone?" It was fun.
You know, I thought it was interesting on Twitter on Sunday. We had Alex Wilhelm, who's a millennial. And he said, "I don't have a phone icon on the front of my smartphone anymore. I took that off."
Wow.
And I thought about it, and I thought, you know, I never use the phone either.
Yeah.
If I'm gonna call somebody, I'll call them direct, or I'll say, "Okay, Google," maybe. But I've never. Sorry, I'm not talking to you, Google. So go away. I never use that. So I'm gonna try as an experiment. I'm removing the phone icon from my phone.
Oh, so you're like an aging millennial now?
Yeah. I want to be like you young people.
I'm not a millennial. I'm an Xer.
You're an Xer? What am
Nobody
I?
Cares
I'm a
about
boomer.
Us.
We're boomers, right, Jeff?
Ick. Yeah, you guys are boomers. Us Xers are lost in the middle.
Yeah.
And then there's the Ys. Like, why? So all right, I'll stand corrected. I actually do use FaceTime every time I call my mom, I was going to say every week, but every time I call my mom, she likes that. So when you're visiting with somebody or you miss somebody or a family member, video calls are great.
Yeah, I'm after this show, my hard stop is to video my daughter and see how the first day of school went. So
today's the first day of school.
Yeah.
We do it with our son. Our son's in UK. And randomly, a mixture of Skype and Facebook Messenger.
I think Skype's even suffering from this because it is built into all the Messenger programs now, and you already have somebody in the Messenger program. It just makes sense to do a video call that way.
Yeah.
Does curiosity? I don't know. Does Facebook still use Skype? They used to, or they have their own protocol now.
They have their own stuff.
Yeah. Everybody should. I think I'll bet you the number one reason for Duo is to raise awareness of WebRTC, which is a great technology, and I don't think is widely known.
But the thing is, it's still a silo. It doesn't actually interoperate with WebRTC, as far as I can tell.
No, it doesn't. That's true. That's a stupid thing. Yeah.
Right. So, the thing that Hangouts is built on the same basic stack,
right?
And it was designed to go between desktop and phone and go everywhere. But part of that is what makes it a little bit clunky to use. Whereas I think this is they've started from, I want a one-button way to call people. And they've got the knock-knock thing, which is, I'm not completely convinced by that product decision. I haven't actually been through do you have to approve people before they can do that to you?
No. You can block them.
They may already have exposed themselves to you at that point. That's the bit that makes me nervous.
I agree. That's the first thought I had is, I know what I'm going to be getting. But that's probably why it uses phone numbers, right? Because that's presumed to be a little more.
But how does it then know that the other person has Duo?
It does, because as soon as you install Duo, you're suddenly showed up.
Oh, you're in their directory.
Yeah.
They then know everybody who has Duo.
Right.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
Well, the same way that WhatsApp knows who you've got WhatsApp and who's just a phone number, right?
Right. Yeah, WhatsApp uses the phone number to figure out who you know.
Yeah.
So if I have a bunch of people in my phone, like my work contacts as part of my Google account, those people are going to automatically be able to call me if I download Duo and they have it?
Yep.
Oh, that sucks.
Well, they already have your phone number.
I know, but...
They could call you on the phone.
But
I have my
them.
Curlers in.
And I don't,
Well...
I guess I ignore them. I don't have to see their faces.
You can disable that part. There should be a way to forward to voice. Wouldn't that be nice?
That's exactly. Or at least, just turn off the camera, same as you can on Skype. Just, I'm going to do a voice call instead of a video call.
Yeah.
Right. There's a one-button solution for that, yeah.
But the phone number binding thing is a bit weird. Signal does this too, which is even weirder. So, Signal is the encrypted chat app. And it's secure, and it's supposed to be a good thing for journalists to use for sources and stuff like that. Except that because it uses phone number, it does the your friend just joined Signal thing. It's like... My friend probably just joined Signal to do something confidential. You notifying me about that is not actually a good signal.
It's terrible. That's terrible. Yeah, that's a leak. It's an information leak, a metadata leak. It's not even metadata. That's real data.
WhatsApp was very successful with this, so that's the model they're copying. So WhatsApp said, you got a phone number. We will use the phone number. That's all you have to do. We'll bootstrap off that. We're just replacing text messaging with our infrastructure. So instead of actually paying the phone company, you're just paying data, and you're probably not paying much for data.
The larger story here has nothing to do with Duo, but just the fact that the carrier's infrastructure for making phone calls is rapidly being usurped, just as the cable companies has been, by the internet. And your daughter probably won't make telephone calls in her life. She'll be doing data calls from now on.
Was it 2012 or 2014 that data surpassed voice? But the carriers have known this was coming for a long time. They tried to do a bunch of things to stop it. The FCC was like, stop trying to do that. And now they've kind of accepted it to a certain extent. They've built all these apps of their own trying to kind of compete with the massive web companies. Although, and Kevin, I don't know if you know about this. Did you see how the EU is looking at imposing some of the same burdens on the infrastructure, so the Facebooks and Skypes of the world, as they are on carriers as part of kind of a telecom relations? Yes? No? Maybe?
Yes. I've seen bits of that. I haven't actually followed the latest edition, but they've done effectively, it's sort of common carrier type rules. But they've also previously done things about broadcasting So they basically tried to take television broadcasting rules and apply that to online video and things, which is a less coherent mapping, because obviously, and the problem is that the EU rules were all written at the time when there was a state monopoly broadcaster and a state monopoly phone company. And in lots of European companies, there still kind of is, but that has changed. And so they've got a mapping problem they're trying to make sense of there. But I haven't seen the specific ones about the phone things yet. I mean,
okay.
Is it 9/11 type regs and those kinds of things, or?
I'm waiting for my Forbes quote of the day to get out of my way so I can.
We've all been there.
Okay, so let's see. Whoop whoop! Stop! Okay, so it is the European Commission is preparing to announce a review of the EU's e-privacy law later this year. And it will include new measures forcing, quote unquote, over-the-top messaging services to follow the same kinds of privacy rules that telcos do. So this is Facebook. There's noise.
That's all right.
Facebook,
we barely
Skype,
hear it.
Et cetera, Viber, all these.
You know, there's kind of an irony there because I would say in some cases these are much more private systems. For instance, Duo is end-to-end encrypted. Your phone call isn't.
You know, the governments hate that.
I know. So I get it. I misinterpreted that. I thought they wanted the internet communications to rise to the level of the telco's privacy. They want them to fall to the level of telco privacy.
Well, that's the other half of this. Is some of this is interception rules. So that's the place where we want to be able to wiretap you. And the British government has been making noises along these lines about outlawing encryption. And you know, even the change of prime minister was not make a lot of difference because the prime minister, the previous Home Secretary, was pushing this very hard.
Yeah, so Theresa May is the Snoopers Charter sponsor.
Exactly. So there is.
Boy.
So there's that level of stuff. The other thing is that they have the actual privacy thing is the data protection stuff, where they say in order to share information about people, you have to have consent and you have to be able to give that information to people. So. In the American companies, they're creating this database of who knows whom and the contacts and stuff like that.
The metadata.
Then they're using that to cross construct other things.
Yeah.
In the EU, that would require them to file some forms and make sure that they're fitting regulations. So it's a sort of a slight difference of regulatory point of view there. But the interception stuff is going to be tricky, and again, I'm not sure that's consistently agreed across Europe either.
Well, I think that's why you're seeing a land rush for these encrypted applications. Why WhatsApp and Facebook and Google are all adopting end-to-end encryption to preempt any measures by governments. Although it doesn't mean the government can't do it, but what it does do is that means the government now has to face the prospect of losing Facebook and losing WhatsApp. And you saw what happened in Brazil when they tried to shut down WhatsApp.
Yeah,
I mean, I understand Putin's government has, you know, Putin signed an order that required that. I don't know what the upshot of it is. I haven't heard anything since. I'm sure his state police told him, well, you can order us to do that. Doesn't mean we can.
Well, but that's, you know, in Russia, they have their own Google equivalent, their own Facebook equivalent.
They can be ordered to, right?
Under their thumb.
Yeah. But nobody, even Putin, is going to throw Facebook out of Russia, or WhatsApp, or any number of apps, or Google.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the reality penetration is there. I haven't actually tracked it recently.
Yeah, maybe that's why you can do that there. But it would also explain why Google might rush to get this stuff out, and Facebook might rush to get this stuff out now, so that harder to force a backdoor.
And it's, you know, it's the crypto community has been working hard to encourage this and to push this for a while.
Yeah.
And adjusting it so you actually got perfect forward secrecy and things like that make a difference.
Yeah. Perfect forward secrecy is crucial because that way, you know, even if they've been collecting it, they can't retroactively decrypt it.
Right. If they get hold of your key, they can't decrypt previous calls, which is a problem with PGP and the sort of first pass of encryption models is that once you have the private key, then you can decrypt everything that's ever
all the
sent.
Emails I've sent with my PGP key, which is why, by the way, you should change your PGP key fairly regularly. But all the emails I've used the PGP key on would be then compromised the minute they get the key. Not with perfect forward secrecy. Those remain encrypted conversations.
Yes. So it's basically automating that key changing, in effect.
Yeah. All right. Fuchsia. That's Kevin Mark's skin tone. And...
I need a different color backdrop to make me look less pink.
It's appropriate that you're here, Kevin, because you're probably the only person that could explain...
I've been waiting for this.
What this is all about. So
I need to read about it first, but okay.
Well, I'll tell you a little what I know about it. Google posted on GitHub an open source version of what they're saying will be a new operating system. It uses little kernel, which is a kind of a real-time extra small kernel. And it is, according to Google, appropriate for every operating system, every setup from IoT all the way up to desktop. A lot of what we've actually learned from just going to the GitHub post, because all the source code is already up. And you can see what kernel, they call the kernel the Magenta kernel, but it is based on Little Kernel. Is it called Little Kernel? I think it's called Little Kernel.
So this is post Linux?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, instead of Linux, yeah.
Let's see, relationship with LK. LK is a kernel designed for small systems, typically embedded. So it's a real-time operating system for embedded. Fuchsia could be used that way. But Magenta has additional features like first-class user mode support, an object handle system, and capability-based security model that Little Kernel does not have. Presumably because they want to make it available on the desktop as well. So this Fuchsia thing is very interesting. Why? Google already has two operating systems, Chrome OS and Android.
Those are both on Linux, and they've done some work to converge their Linux kernel between them, but I'm not sure that's fully PEN. I forgot the name of the project, but they did some work to try and do that. But then there's a bunch of sort of baked-in assumptions in Linux that may make it harder to do some things. You know, the obvious one is the way audio works there. Which is clearly worse on Linux than it is on the iOS kernel.
Yep.
Because it's a push model rather than a pull model, which means you end up accumulating buffers. So it may be that they've started to step back and say, rather than try and make that kind of deep change to Linux, it may be easier to start with something else and just put, you know, our system level layer on top. But the other thing is, you know, this is Google. It may be an experiment. Just because Google has published something doesn't mean this is their strategic direction. They have lots of, you know, parallel things going on at once. The difference between them and Apple is they just do them slightly more in public.
For all we know, this is somebody's 20% project, right? I mean,
right. Now, Apple built several different operating system things internally, but only shipped a few of them. And Google is probably doing the same thing, but maybe with a slightly more visibility here.
The tagline, and maybe you can help us understand this, pink plus purple equals fuchsia. Now, I do remember there was a pink operating system. This was an Apple-IBM joint venture, right?
Yes.
But I don't know if that's what they mean.
I'm not sure what the reference is there. That was a long time ago. That was like 20 years ago.
Yeah, I don't think it could be that. And I don't know what purple is. The only purple I can remember is libpurple, which is the libraries that allow you to do messaging with Pigeon and other messaging programs. So yeah. I'm not sure what pink plus purple equals.
I'm not quite sure what they're
maybe they just Maybe it's just a color lesson. Someday we'll all know. I think it's intentionally unclear, which is fun.
It's the new wave Google Plus.
Oh, Google Plus. Gosh, that still breaks my heart.
We hardly knew ye.
We hardly knew ye. No one knew ye. That was the problem.
So my sort of bottom line here is, It's another operating system experiment at Google. There's lots of things they could be planning to use it for. We don't know yet.
It doesn't have Java in it.
It uses Dart, right?
Well, I'm suspicious that they use
it's
Dart.
Based on Dart. They said it's written in Dart.
Based on Dart.
Yeah.
But Dart, you know, if it's actually a kernel, that doesn't make any difference. You know, what they would want to do is get a stack up running on it. They can run, you know, Chrome and Android and things on top of it.
Is Dart LLL, what is it, LVL? What is it, LVM? What is it, Dart?
Yeah, Google compile to LVM. I mean, Dart is basically like mutant JavaScript that's a bit more Java.
Yeah, but an operating system written in JavaScript, now the future is here.
Well, but, you know, we've had those, you know.
Yeah, but only toys.
That was Palm OS and Firefox OS. We've had those. I mean, my TV is being run by one.
Right.
The LG TV that has a
robot. I do too. It's Palm OS. It's so funny. I look at it and go, oh.
This is kind of.
There's no cards, but I feel like there's, in that interface, there's stuff popping up. I feel like those could be cards.
Yes.
They just haven't popped them up yet or something.
A little cards at the bottom that can turn into full screen apps. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of fun.
But yeah, you know, there's. So it's a project. We don't know what size of a project is. And to say, oh, this is going to take over from the other ones, well, that would involve quite a lot of change and not that likely.
But you I think the reason there's this speculation, I mean, that's obviously true. The reason there's this speculation is you can think of some business reasons why Google would want to get out from under Java, would want to get out from under Linux. Samsung's doing Tizen for kind of the same reason they want to get out from under Google.
Android.
Yeah. So you can kind of understand that.
But at some point, you know, for it to be useful as an operating system, you have to put a web browser on it, at which point you've put Chrome on it, at which point you've recreated
Chrome OS with
some missing plumbing.
Right.
With some different plumbing, which is a perfectly sensible thing to do. Android, there's more baggage there, but they're working on making that work because you know, they're doing the Android on Chrome thing as well. So in principle, you can do that. In practice, there's a bunch of work to do to make those bits combine, and there's still the work to actually get the thing ported to a bunch of lower-level drivers and stuff like that. So we don't, you know, when Firefox were bringing their things up, they were basically building something that would run on top of an Android phone. Because that's what exists, and this would be the same thing. It's the question of at what layer in the stack are you suddenly just deciding things are different?
We'll be talking about kernels next week on Security Now. We were talking on Twit about microkernels versus, you know, whatever the opposite is, big normal kernels and tiny kernel and little kernel. And Steve wanted to clarify everything for us. So. If you're interested in kernels, the notion of kernels, having to do with this as well, with Fuchsia, next Wednesday at Security Now. Google is killing Hangouts on Air, or, well, at least shifting it away from Google Plus and making it YouTube Live. Another blow to Hangouts. I just don't get what's going on with Hangouts. I really don't.
I don't either.
It can't die soon enough for me.
You don't like it? Well, you don't need to use it.
Right. No, I know. But every time we try to use it, just it never worked. I love it in theory. I love the idea that I could be talking to someone and be like, hey, let's take this to, like, IMing someone and be like, hey, let's take it to voice or let me show you something, you know, on video. But it's not that easy. I don't like it.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
Well, Google even says when you get Google Fi, oh, don't use Hangouts anymore. You should be using Messages.
Right.
Yes.
Which is a very, by the way, nothing program. Doesn't do anything.
Yep.
Well, the thing is, they had the SMS app that was part of the built-in Android one, the open source one. And then they said, oh, we'll use Hangouts. And then they thought Messages. And then there's Google Voice. So I've now got three separate Google apps that want to take over my SMS.
Yeah. Not to mention Facebook Messenger, which I used for a while.
Yes.
And I can't wait to Allo. I guess, will Allo be, will it take over for Hangouts? Will it be the new thing?
Well, but I suspect that's what they're thinking. They're saying, okay, we're going to refactor this into separate stuff. And obviously, it's much more fun to work on a shiny new product than it is to keep the old one running.
And that's, and by the way, was it you who said that that's the structural problem within Google? Does the engineers are allowed to choose what projects they want to work on. So you always, all the shiny new stuff gets all the attention. And it's hard to get a good engineer to keep working on the kind of maintenance.
No, I'm not sure that's fully true. I think, you know, maintenance is respected there as well. They do reward that too. So it's not just like, but you know, Apple has that problem too. Apple is very bad at, has been in the past, oh, let's make a new thing rather than maintain the old one.
Yeah, nobody's maintaining iTunes apparently.
Right. So, you know, do you remember iChat? iChat was actually pretty cool.
iChat was good. Yeah, and it was standards based.
They never shipped it on the phone.
Wasn't it XMPP? XMPP?
It was XMPP. It would interoperate with.
That's what killed. By the way, can I just
the video chat on that was standardized as well.
Yeah.
And then they never ported that to iOS, and then they went away and built FaceTime. And Steve Jobs says, "Oh, we'll open source this tomorrow." And you know,
yeah, never did. Never did.
We're still waiting.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's you know, to say to say this, you know, actually the company that's most coherent about this has been Facebook. And even there, they bought another company because the other company is successful. But if you actually look at the way that Messenger works, it's a lot more coherent than the Google thing was.
How old would you guess Hangouts is? Don't say if you know.
When did it come out?
Yeah, don't try to figure it out. It was 5 years, 10 years. How long have we had it? A long time. Feels like we've had a long time. It's 3 years old. You're right, Jeff. 3 years old. That's all.
It's only 3 years old.
That's all it is.
Wow. It would be a little bit of good data journalism to do a kind of half-life of Google projects.
Uh-huh. Wouldn't that be interesting?
Oh, well, that's the site death page on IndieWeb. You've seen that, right? IndieWeb.org/site-deaths has the list of all the things that have been abandoned and have lost people's data. And it's a long list.
So, by the way, how do you feel about XMPP disappearing? I was really excited about XMPP, and I was really disappointed that Google abandoned it. Was there a good technical reason for that, Kevin?
It's a complicated protocol. You know, it was very XML heavy, and there was a bunch of cruft in it. You could probably make a case that you could do things more optimally than sending stuff that way. But there was a nice interop action with it, and you know, it was used by Facebook and Google and AOL and a bunch of people. You could actually interop with it, and then that gradually got broken. So
I feel like all of this that we're talking about would have been eliminated if everybody had just gotten behind XMPP.
To some extent, but the problem is it was bound to email addresses.
It was federatable. Well, that's another thing, by the way. Why are we bound to phone numbers, especially if the telephone service is done? Why is POTS our unique number? Why isn't it an email address?
Yeah, can you imagine a date pretty soon when you, just as you don't have a landline, you don't have a phone, you have a connected computer, you have...
Yeah, what do you need a landline?
What do you need a
landline? And a phone number is not memorable. Why a phone number? Why not an email address or something else? But why not an email? And XMPP was interoperable. It was federatable. It was very flexible. Yeah, I know it was XML, but it was very, because of that, it was very parsable and extensible. It was highly extensible.
Yep.
I just, that makes me sad. Anyway, here's the list of site deaths. When sites go offline, taking your content with them. And you can see them all as you scroll.
Upcoming ones, and then
any day now, paper data app, Getorious.
Are you doing physical devices too, or just software or services and software products?
We could do physical. We'll accept edits. It's a wiki, but it was mostly software products. I mean, it started out with we've
this is
down
fun. Claim ID. I was really into that. Everpix, remember that? Oh man, this is depressing. Lava Bit. We know why they went out of business. This is fun. I'm glad somebody put this together.
So, now,
what's the CMS on this, by the way? Is this a wiki?
It's MediaWiki.
MediaWiki.
Yeah.
Love MediaWiki. Thank you, MediaWiki. It's a kind of heavyweight wiki, but it works. Gets the job done.
Yeah.
TwitPic. Remember them? Glad they went away.
Well, they kind of got eaten by the
host. They're still around, but someday Twitter. Is Twitter on this list? You know what? I'm
too
sorry.
Soon.
No, Twitter is. Didn't you love the article?
Yeah.
Twitter is a honeypot for a-holes. Well researched.
Yeah, it was.
And it kind of said it all. And Twitter's response was the most anemic response ever.
Well, they've always made anemic response. I mean, the interesting thing for me reading that was remembering Ariel's initial complaints about it, because they brought up Ariel.
I didn't realize Ariel had been very early on. She's wonderful. What a terrible story.
Yeah.
And that's how this begins. This is Charlie Walzel's BuzzFeed article. Inside Twitter's 10-year failure to stop harassment. What I didn't realize is one of the very first people to be harassed was Ariel Waldman in 2008 when Twitter was about a year old. And Jack Dorsey promised to fix it, never did. Nobody fixed it, never did. She still uses Twitter. She still loves Twitter. Because what? Stockholm syndrome? Because...
Well, because, you know, because people are still there. I mean, the thing is, in her initial case, it was someone who'd been stalking her elsewhere had moved on to Twitter as well.
And Twitter gave them... space. Twitter was like fertilizer. It was like right. sunshine, rain, and just everything it needed to grow.
Well, that's, it was troll food under the bridge.
I just linked to my piece I read in 2014 on this, which was for me, it was a structural thing, which was that the thing that they changed at the time, looking back at the responses they made to Ehrlich in 2008, they were basically saying, no, no, Twitter isn't a platform for harassment because you choose what you see. You don't, it's not a place that people can just come at you. You have to go to your @tab to see it, and by default you won't see it in your stream. And that was true in 2008, and they broke that gradually over the years, and they've switched it from a place where your primary view was of things you'd chosen to follow,
like Google Plus,
to now the most urgent thing that can happen is somebody has added you, which means it's become both an email inbox and also under your tweet any. Response from any random person is shown in chronological order and threaded. So it's also brought in the worst of blog comments as well. So they managed to combine the sort of the worst of email addresses, having an open address that you can't turn stuff off, with the worst of blog comments in the service of increasing interaction.
And as a friend of mine, as Google said long ago, it's the problem, Kevin, we've talked about this too, that when things are sender controlled, the recipient becomes the victim.
Yes. Yeah.
So if you saw that Leslie Jones, a victim of Twitter sump pumpery, just started a hashtag supporting Gabby Douglas for all the hell that she's gone
that
through.
Was great.
Why do we keep going back there? It's not that good. I think we can do without it. Why do people keep going back? Why is Stephen Fry back on Twitter? Why did Leslie Jones go back?
Because they
suspended Milo Yiannopoulos, but that wasn't. That was the guy. It was the least of it, and we want to stay on Twitter, but why? I don't understand the loyalty to it.
Well, there's two things going on there. Well, one is it's the memory of when it was good. In the same way that we keep using email, even though most of it is spam.
I stopped using that too. Yeah,
we kind of remember when getting an email from someone you didn't know was an assignment.
It's like me and Taco Bell.
Nostalgia, you're saying, or Chipotle.
There is a set of us who got on Twitter early who had this mode of talking in public and having a conversation.
Oh, it was so awesome in the early days.
That it picks up on the blogging model as well of that semi-overlapping public and the ability to see bits and pieces.
And I keep trying to use, you know, StatusNet or the open, and it just doesn't have the same.
Yeah, it doesn't have the
critical mass.
It gains from scale. I mean the. But the problem is, the other thing that's, you know, the reason this is hard is that Twitter is built to move things between these different subgroups. And so it started out with just the subgroups, but then there's ways of bridging between them with hashtags, with @replies, and so on, so that you can move stuff from one place to another. But it's hard to tell what is, just in systematic terms, what is the big trend thing that we should all be seeing, and a sort of attack on somebody else without doing content analysis, without actually checking it closely, and that's the bit that's structurally difficult. The other thing is Paul Ford called it the other day, Twitter is the angry social network, which I thought was a very good way of summing it up. Twitter is basically the place you go to shout at the cloud. When you have bad service, you go and shout at companies on Twitter. And this is actually a good business for Twitter and to some extent for the companies, because they're actually getting this feedback and the ability to respond to people who are the most upset customers in real time. So there is a sort of structural value in that. It was also the place where you complained about your government and were able to start revolutions and things and so on. So
where you tore down the government by launching a presidential campaign at that. Yeah.
Yeah. But the challenge is, it's a bit like, you know, the problem with Facebook is that, everyone you see on Facebook has more friends than you and is having a better time, because A, the people who have more friends spread more widely, and B, you only post the positive things on Facebook. So you have this effect that it feels like your life is shit compared to what you see on Facebook. Well, Twitter, everyone you see on Twitter is angrier than you, and also their anger is getting more traction than yours because for the same effect. The angry things get traction, they're spread, they're retweeted, they're shared. That is amplified round in the loop. So, you know, most tweets are, if you actually just like look at a stream of tweets at random, most tweets are anodyne and calm and so on. But that's not the perception you get when you look at Twitter. You see it being this place that people shout at each other because that's what's amplified. And therefore, you start treating it as the place you go to shout at people. And so they've managed to take it from this, the place where you would just like send notes about what you're doing your day and your friends would see them and tweet about your lunch or whatever it is, to this place where it's the place you go to shout at people that you don't know.
Why would you want to go there? I can understand why you'd want to shout there. But why would you?
I learn about so many new tech. I mean, like, I follow such a diverse group of people.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are super nerdy. And they'll start talking about, I don't know, a new programming language or something they've seen that they're excited about. And
I go to Hacker News for that. I go to, there's lots of other places you can get that stuff.
There are. But, I mean, Hacker News, it's already been written by the time it's on Hacker News. So
yeah,
as
and
a
I see people. I agree, Stacey. I see people like you know. I just put something on the rundown a second ago from Benedict Evans, Mark Andreessen quotes, Josh Marshall tweets. I mean, there's Fred Wilson tweets. There's just all kinds of amazing people there who I wouldn't see otherwise.
And right. I mean, the other thing is, I actually feel like I have a nice community on Twitter. I have a lot of people who are like engage with me on, you know, crazy questions about smart homes or just tell me that I'm wrong in a respectful way and then educate me, but not in a jerk way.
Knock some wood, Stacey. Knock some wood.
But I feel like, I don't know. I like it, but I also feel that most human beings are good. So
clearly. I do too. I used to anyway.
I do too. No, until Twitter. It's the bad apples that ruin
Twitter.
The
I swear to God. Twitter's ruined my opinion of humanity. That's reason enough not to go there.
That was the Twitter that was built. It was the thing that they were saying in response to error was you choose who you see, you choose who you hear from, and you've got to make your choices. So part of it was that. And those of us who spent time deciding who we follow and so on, that still works. But the challenge is, for the, you know, the sign up flow now forces you to follow publishing entities, famous people, verified people, news sources, and so on. It says, pick one of these. We're not going to let you go through until you've got 30 people in your following stream, so you have something in your stream. So the sense of actually choosing people to follow, you know, organically has gone. And they may have needed to do that to get people to sign up at scale. But what it means is most people's perception of Twitter is that it's not that place where you have conversations with people. It's a place where famous people talk to each other and you sort of shout into the void at them.
Twitter makes me feel like a battered husband, and I suspect Ariel Waldman feels the same way. And I feel like I just keep making excuses for it, and I keep going back, and I keep.
So here's the
hit.
Question, Leo: is, I mean, you know, because there was a lot of complaint during the Olympics that Twitter was quick taking down anything that the IOC did.
They take down
Ariel Waldman.
Yeah.
All right. So tomorrow you're in charge of Twitter.
I don't want to be in charge of Twitter. No.
Can you fix it?
I'm going to shut it down. If I were in charge of it, I'd shut it down. I'd give the give the shareholders their money back and say thank you very much. Bye bye. Bye bye.
Well, I take that.
What do you want to do? And I apologize for bringing this up again because we've really talked about this.
Hash this to death.
Ad infinitum, ad nauseum, years. And this is part of the abuse cycle. But how could you fix this? What would you do? But it's so great, but there's so much there.
Okay, so the point is there isn't a quick fix. The problem is it is a cultural problem, and you would have to disentangle the cultural elements in it. So if I was put in charge of Twitter, I would hire a bunch of sociologists, analysts of that nature to study this more closely and not just use simple engineering metrics like engagement.
Go ahead, Stacey, sorry.
I was going to say, bring Dana Boyd on. She can hire from Microsoft.
Example, but you know, she's busy. Basically hire a team of people like Dana to analyze this and look at it from those perspectives and say, what is this doing? How is this affecting things? But also have this sense of, the point is, if you think of it as publics, this is a sort of literary theory thing of each work has a public, each tweet has a public. Each person's set of tweets has a public. Yes. And the idea is the public is the people that thing is was written for, and then the people who respond to it and go to that. And look at it in those terms and rethink it as this network of overlapping publics, and think about how you can decide that, rather than to building a single overall ranking and collection and most popular and most treated, work out how you can make those publics coexist.
I also think that we just have to get to the point where the problem, you're going to have trolls. You have trolls in life. You have criminals in life. You have people who need beds in life. It's the problem with Twitter. The problem with all of this is the encouragement that the same people give them and the encouragement they get to do that. Oh, that's so funny. Oh, that's so wonderful. Let's go after. And the reward systems are set up wrong, and we've got to change that fundamentally. We've got to change the rest of society, Kevin. I think you're right.
It's not just the rest of society. It is, you know, there is a difference. There isn't a set of affordances that amplify certain behaviors. So, you know, classically, if you're having a discussion on an email list, it will end up being a back and forth with you quoting each other, because that's how you discuss on email lists. If you're having a discussion on a wiki, it will end up in an edit war, because that's how you debate on wikis. You delete each other's stuff until there's something left, and that can lead to a different outcome. At least the wiki, there'll be something at the end of it. But you may have deleted all the argument, but there'll be something there. Whereas the email list, all there is this giant cross ongoing exchange that nobody cares about in the end. And Twitter had picked up something from the blogging world, which was this sense that you can't see the whole conversation, but you can see bits of it and follow parts of it and make sense. But they atomized it into these small pieces that were kind of composable, so that you could have a conversation that went back and forth without the effort of doing the block quote response type stuff that we do when we write the longer blog posts. But as I say, the change they made in emphasizing at replies without a sense of who you were following kind of broke that model, in that they've got bits of it that can bring back, but they changed the defaults. So the defaults are still designed to get stuff to flow more quickly and amplify it. And if you look at it as our goal is to get stuff to spread more, that's what you do. But actually, a very small amount of Twitter is that stuff that should spread that far and cross all these groups. And there's much more value in the stuff that happens within groups. So modeling that better and understanding how you could do that would be the interesting part. And you know, they've probably spent a bunch of time looking at this and trying to make sense of it. But they have been very focused, for obvious and sensible reasons, on making sure that the people who are have millions of followers and who are public figures have that work for them. And they somehow lost the middle of people who suddenly become famous or suddenly have their thing take off and have sort of transitioned from I'm talking to 20 friends to I'm suddenly in front of the entire world and things are going weird.
Like Gabby Douglas.
Like Gabby Douglas.
That's so tragic.
But,
Gabby does, you know, you could predict that because she was on television. She was, you know, she had been bootstrapped from that platform.
Yeah. Being intelligent make you a target, a legitimate target?
Yeah, argument is, oh, you're public. You deserve this.
She's an athlete.
But it means that you're a target for attention. You suddenly have a large amount of attention. They can predict that. They know to do this for, you know, contestants in American Idol, things like that. They'll set them up. They'll have someone work it out so that they're filtered and modeling that. The tougher thing is when somebody, you know, invents the hashtag that catches the political zeitgeist, and then they're rocketed to them, and then they become the target of the opposing faction, and who will then try and tear them down and work that out. And that's when the harassment piles up.
I feel like it's facilitated, and this, the Gabby Douglas thing is a great example. It's facilitated this kind of gotcha. Quick to judge.
Oh, God, yeah.
Meaningless.
No. People have always been like that.
They haven't had a platform. And now you can trash somebody. I mean, you can really trash somebody. You can cause somebody to lose their job. You can put people, you know, in horrific. You can have people kill themselves. I mean, she was devastated because she didn't put her hand over her heart.
Right.
This is ridiculous. You could
do that with a television station or a newspaper.
Not in anywhere near pervasive, evil way. Yeah.
No, this is just...
It's just terrible. It's just terrible. Anyway, I don't want to talk about it anymore. My personal choice is not to have anything to do with it. I don't even want to talk about wither Twitter anymore. Ford had an event in Silicon Valley right before IDF. Coincidence? I don't know. In which they announced By 2021, wait a minute, let me check. That's 5 years from now. They're going to have a fleet of Type 4 fully autonomous cars operating in a ride-hailing service. What? You think that's possible? 5 years from now that we'll be ride-hailing a driverless vehicle?
No.
It's so funny because for years, when Alan Mulally was the CEO and people were starting to talk about autonomous vehicles, I would ask Alan every time I interviewed him, so what's going on with Ford and autonomous vehicles? And he said, oh, no, people love to drive. We're never going to do autonomous vehicles. I said, come on, you got a Skunk Works. You got a place in the back there. You're doing it. No, people love to drive. Now level four is not fully autonomous. It's one level below. So you do need, I guess, a driver. I'm not clear what Ford's saying they're going to do here.
So to get a fully autonomous car, like level five, is that NHTSA levels? We need to have a regulatory overhaul, an insurance overhaul, and a lot of big conversations. So the idea that that's all going to happen before 2021, I think, is ludicrous.
Yeah.
So, and I think the media is somewhat complicit in talking about autonomous vehicles and being like, this is a self-driving car, when in fact we shouldn't be calling them that. We kind of got in trouble with that in Tesla with the autopilot. Tesla also called it autopilot.
And I think they were wrong to do that. I think they still are. Yeah. They've stopped doing it in China.
Yes. But I think that this idea is great, and we have a lot of technology that's going to get us there. By 2021, we're going to have some really awesome vehicles on the road. And our participation could be very little, but we're not going to be able to hop in our like little pods and have it zip us off places and then go zip off and park on its own. And
no, they're saying level four, but they're also saying that the biggest cost of having a ride sharing service is the driver. So it implies they're going to get rid of the driver. So I don't know exactly. Maybe I will have to sit behind the wheel of my taxi cab just to make sure it doesn't run into something.
No way. You can do that. Cause if you got, what if
no,
you got
I agree.
Massively trashed?
Yeah, no, that's not going to work.
No, so the point is it'll be a system that works in certain areas and it doesn't try and drive everywhere so it's basically like an automated bus route.
I guess when they say they plan to have a fleet, it could be a fleet of 100 vehicles and it could be in Nebraska. Yeah. We're not sure what that means exactly.
I think that would be a great place actually.
Yeah,
rural areas would be
huge.
Yeah, make a lot of sense.
It's an easier problem in lots of ways, yes.
Tesla says that their next, a rumor says that Tesla's next version will be fully autonomous. Autopilot 2.0.
This is the Model 3?
Well, Elon Musk's goal is by 2019 to have a fully autonomous. Mm-hmm. According to Jalopnik, Tesla's next version of autopilot may go fully autonomous. Now, version 8 of the software is due soon, I think, right? I don't know if they're talking about that. They're talking about a new sensor suite that will allow level 3 autonomous driving, potentially level 4 fully autonomous driving in a not-too-distant future. More radar, front-facing radar, plus side radar, plus a triple camera system. So they're really trying to increase the capabilities of the car. Right now, I have a camera in the front, a camera in the back, and I think radar, and I can't remember. It's not anywhere near enough sensors to really do even level 3.
Man, I've hopped a curb, and the sensors did not help me in that situation.
Yeah, right. So I don't know. I can't decide if this is a hype that's, you know, years off, kind of like artificial intelligence. And
we have to get around. I mean, but
and
in
you're
a way
right.
It's
there's a huge
good.
Regulatory hurdle, too, not just a technical hurdle.
But this actually, by talking about it and setting these deadlines, even if we don't like quite meet them in the way we hoped, it does get people excited. It gets, I mean, legislators are like, oh, now we should think about self-driving cars.
Right. I think that's the point, Stacey, is it puts you know, osmotic
get the
pressure
conversation going. Yeah.
On them. Osmotic and you have states pressure. Competing with each other. We'll be the first state with autonomous sense. Vehicles and all that kind
that
of stuff.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a PR thing. I think you're right.
Yeah.
But did you guys see about Tesla camping? Because that looks really exciting.
Is it? It's a new kind of glamping. What is Tesla camping?
So there's Bloomberg had a story about it, and I thought this was great because people drive their Tesla Model 3s back out into the woods and they leave them on all night because you can have, you know, air conditioning and bugs don't get in or whatever. Yes. I think this is awesome.
So wait, he lived in his trunk?
Well, I mean, he filled the seats back. You can see the pictures if you scroll down. He kind of cherry-rigged this.
Oh, camping mode. Well, I could do this in my Model X. Easy.
Yeah.
We'll have developers doing this in the parking lot of Google soon.
So there's, exactly. There's
I can do this in my
your air conditioning doesn't run. No, but it doesn't run all night without, you know.
There's enough, what you're saying is there's enough battery in there to really do. There's USB ports to keep your phone going. There's dome lights, that LED lights that could run all night. There's air filtration fans.
It's like a portable house you bring to the woods.
Oh, he also says, do yourself a favor. Pick up a portable electric espresso maker, a kettle. Yes. They plug right into the car. What? Now, really, do you have enough juice to do this?
Mm-hmm. That's what I thought was awesome. He's talking about it. It barely used any.
I got to try this.
Well, it's work in California where it's cool at night. Yeah, I'm not sure it works. Well,
that's why it would be great in Texas, because, like, I want to go camping, but you
plus,
really
Theo,
can't.
You can fold up your Casper mattress in the back.
Yeah.
They'd have to give you a camping vacuum pump to slick it back down into its original packaging. I don't know. I thought this was hilarious and awesome. Go people.
He had to throw a towel over the 17-inch screen in the front because it was too bright.
That's a feature for me. My daughter, she likes having a
little nightlight. Yeah, yeah.
So, I'm going to say, it doesn't quite add up because an RV costs less than a Tesla.
Yeah.
Well, the same order of magnitude as a Tesla.
Just if you've already got a Tesla,
I'm not going to. I'm never going to.
You
buy
can
an
live
RV.
It now.
You may need to if you've already got a Tesla.
But also RVs. You know, they have infrastructure. There are parts with hookups. You can go and plug your thing in.
But
and
the cool thing about this is you do have LTE, you have power, you have USB, you have a giant battery.
You just need the Tesla toilet.
Oh.
Yeah, that is missing. But
what you may need is a sort of large solar panel to lay down so that you can line in the morning to recharge the car.
Just camp next to a supercharger. You're cool.
Since I can't afford a Tesla, I'm going to sell my house and just buy that, and then I'll live in it.
Yeah, exactly. I might be doing Teslas. The same. Maybe our new studio. Who knows? I don't know. Audi's cars will be able to tell drivers. I think every car should have this when the red light turns green.
I didn't get this one, Leo. I didn't understand what the benefit of this one was.
Well,
I think it should be when a red light or a green light's about to turn. I know we've got yellow lights, but some yellow lights are shorter than others.
The idea is sometimes you're at a red light. You want to just close your eyes for a minute or cut your nails or text. Now the car will show the time remaining before a light turns green. And then maybe Italy. How does it know, though?
Because it's got this data.
The city's publishing this, huh?
You can know people are going to jump the red. I'm telling you, I'm counting the days till there's an accident around this.
Yeah, because you can go.
People are going to jump the light.
That's making it hard for people who run an orange light, as I like to do.
It's great for drag racing. Orange light. There's no such thing as an orange light. Is that what you've been telling yourself? That is.
That's what you call it.
Red.
When the yellow light turns to red.
It's red.
When orange. You're in the middle of the intersection.
Oh, is that? That's a good name for it. I'll call it that from now on.
They call it amber.
In Europe, they do show you the yellow both ways.
Yeah.
Before it's red and before it's green.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's a good idea, just to let you know.
Yes.
It doesn't buzz you to stop you from clipping your nails, but you shouldn't be doing that anyway.
Kevin, what do you think of Tim Berners-Lee's plan to reclaim the internet from Facebook and Google?
I was slightly amused by this article, given that I wrote another article about this right after the Centralized Web Summit, which actually mentioned more things.
So well, David Weinberger's a pretty good guy to
I was teasing Weinberger about that, but yes. So there's a bunch of things going on. So the Decentralized Web Summit happened in June at Internet Archive, and a bunch of people came, including Tim Berners-Lee and everyone who's working on lots of these projects and worked on that. And this one is sort of highlighting Solid, which is Tim's research project at MIT. It's not a W3C thing. It's based on linked data, but it's basically a privately funded group there that's trying to build something.
And is it a silo for your personal data?
It's supposed to be a sort of you store it on your own server. So it has sort of some in your overlap. The basic idea is you store it on your own server and you bring the app to it, and it gets the data from it there and then sends it back. So it's that kind of model.
So a third party like Google or Facebook could ask for data from my pod.
Yeah.
And I could charge them for that or I'd have permissions.
That's the idea. I mean, the thing, you know, the slightly frustration for me is that we have the social web working group at W3C that's been trying to fit these different components together. And so there's an indie web group set of people there. There's a LinkedIn set of people there. There's a bunch of people who came from activity streams. And we're trying to work out the models of how these things connect together. And Solid has been some contributions to that group, but they haven't. I think they've put one spec into the group so far. Whereas, you know, IndieWeb has put three or four specs in with MicroPub's content candidate recommendation this week and so on. So we're trying to make this stuff fit together, but Tim has not been promoting the W3C part of this. He's been promoting his personal project, which makes sense. If you ask someone, what are you working on? They'll talk about that. And, you know, I'll talk about IndieWeb stuff. He'll talk about Solid stuff. But I think the interesting part is where we're trying to get these specs to work together. And there is a part of the social web working group, there is a paper that describes the different projects we've got and how we're trying to make them interoperate. And that's an interesting one to look at. Let me find the link for that. Because that social web protocols thing that Amy Guy has written, that sort of describes the different protocols we've got and how they connect together and how the indie web ones connect with the activity stream ones that connect with the ones that have come from the other groups. So we're trying to make these things fit together. The indie web approach has been, we'll make some very small point protocols that are easy to implement, and then you can connect things together with that. There are other protocol discussions in here that are trying to be more comprehensive, that are trying to give you an inbox and an outbox and build something that's closer to a sort of a more complete social network rather than a sort of start with your website and build up model. And then Solid is in that realm, but taking it a stage further. So it's saying we're going to use the linked data model, which describes resources on the web and lets you connect them together and express things in the Tim Berners-Lee vision that he's been pushing for a couple of decades now as the sort of the post-web of the web of linked data. So it's trying to use that worldview and connect that in with the web. And the challenge with all of these is, can we actually get them interoperate, or do they only interoperate with things that are running the same code base that are actually the same thing? And that's the piece that's hard, and the mapping between, I think, is the important bit here.
Very good.
I will find you the article I wrote that has.
I will read your article too.
But yeah, so the social web working group is the sort of the W3C group that's trying to put this stuff together. I'll put the link to that in the chat as well. And there's a series of drafts and candidate recommendations that are coming out of that group. The social web protocols is the one that explains the connection between the different ones and how we're trying to make it work together. Candidate recommendations are the ones that we think are in a state where they're implementable. And then there are working drafts that are trying to build different pieces of this, but are not ready for... It's basically gathering implementations and trying to converge. MicroPub is a candidate recommendation. That's derived from the IndieWeb work. WebMention is a editor's draft, working draft. It seems to be in that list. But basically, we've got a set of these different protocols, and we're trying to make them all fit together. And the
WebMention is a candidate recommendation.
WebMention is a candidate recommendation as well. Yeah.
Yeah, this is interesting.
So there's been a lot of us trying to work on different bits of this over the last, I think it's 2 years now. This group has been chartered, and Solid is one of the is Tim's research group at MIT, and it has people that are part of this group as well. But what I would say is, if you're interested in this stuff, have a look at the social web working group stuff, because we've got a bunch of actually interoperating drafts and things there, and there's connections to the Solid work there as well. The linked data notifications came out of the Solid group that's in there as a working draft.
w3.org/wiki/socialwg for social web working group.
Yes, capital S, I think you need.
Oh, it's cap. Oh, case sensitive. K
Capital.
It's a wiki.
It's a wiki.
No, it does work. Okay, so yes, okay. Social WG.
Who put these purple links in here? These look suspiciously like Stacy's interests.
Uh-oh. I didn't have time to drop anything.
What I learned is a hired consultant to autodidact physicists. Oh, maybe that's a Kevin Marks.
This is a Kevin
Marks. That was like a Kevin Marks.
This was a fun one.
All right.
This is fascinating.
What is it?
So
this is from Eon. The reason I thought it might be you, Stacey, I know you like to read Eon.
I do. Well, Kevin and I have a lot of similar interests. I'm not going to lie.
Yes, that's true.
We do tend to nerd out together. So Sabine Hersenfelder, she's a research physicist. And she said, one of the problems you have as a research physicist is there are all these people who have strange theories who contact your physics department and want to tell you about them. And you try and be nice and do that. But so,
she put a note up on her blog offering physics consultations. Talk to a physicist. Call me on Skype, $50 per 20 minutes.
Yes.
Oh, is that where you got your idea, Kevin?
This is exactly where I got the idea, yeah. So okay. She says, okay. And she talks about what happened. And she found it was actually really interesting. So there's a sort of set of people who learn about physics from the media, who have some sort of loose understanding of how it works, but have taken some piece of a visualization or a simplified explanation to heart.
Completely misunderstood.
They've solved it.
Yeah.
And so the service that she provides is they ring her up and say, so I think we can get perpetual energy from this because of this, 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 and this. And she'd say, the thing that you've misunderstood is this piece, and you should read a paper about this. And
how useful.
And do it from that point of view.
Does she get calls?
And she says she got a lot of calls. She got enough calls that she had to recruit other graduate students to respond to it as well.
That's so awesome. Yeah.
And based upon this pricing, just talking to Kevin for the length of this show, we've actually had, let's see, $300, I think.
That's true. I should have to invoice. No, so I thought that I also did this. I put this up on Twitter and said, interesting business model. If you're interested, want to talk to me for 20 minutes for $50, I'll do that too. And I've had some people respond and actually had some really interesting conversations out of it.
I thought about just saying hi, but then I was like, no, too rich for my blood.
Well, here's what this reminds me of is this recent article in the New York Times and elsewhere debunking chemtrails. And we've all seen these contrails from jets in the sky. It's commonplace. I've seen them since I was a kid. But apparently there are a group of conspiracy theorists who are convinced, I'd never heard of this, who are convinced that these are actually government planes spraying toxic chemicals.
You're going to get the email now.
Gene-altering concoctions, testing weapons of war. So somebody decided
these
to do a peer-reviewed study. And scientists agreed. Well, not all. 77 scientists. 76 of them said they had no evidence of secret large-scale spraying programs and could easily explain those trails as condensation, not spraying. There was one scientist, who said, well... So even in this case, you're never going to get 100% agreement, but... That's an example of something where it's... I didn't know this. Is it widely believed that we are being sprayed?
Widely would not be the case, no.
Well, no, but there's a it's widely spoken about. There's a sort of coalition of people who talk about this and link to each other.
Oh, Lord.
And because of the sort of, you know, Facebook and Twitter the application internet. Models, the internet, they can find each other. But
I'm telling you, it's all Twitter's fault.
But literally, if you sign up for one of these sites on Facebook, if you follow them, it will recommend the other 8 for you.
Yeah,
you know, they're
right.
It's a very well correlated cluster, and it connects to some of the other ones as well.
Yeah,
and that, you know, and the challenge, you know, it is, you know, we do
17% in an international survey, 17% said they believed in a secret large scale atmospheric program or SLAP to be true. Or partly true. 17%.
I would love for someone to do, I think Gawker actually for a while did something like, it wasn't called Camping with the Crazies, but it was like...
It should be. That's a good name.
They hung out with conspiracy theorists and cults, and they reported on them, like what these people believed and like just showing like how many groups of weird there are. And I think it'd just be a fascinating podcast because sometimes like, you stumble across these weird areas of the internet and you're like, wow, there are really people that believe, like the flat earthers. I didn't know those people still existed until whoever that was got all excited. I love that. I love people.
I don't know if you want to fuel that fire, however.
Yeah, I don't think so. It's the same with the anti-vaxxers and all that.
Yeah.
Or the people who believe Wi-Fi is bad for you.
There's a guy who lives in Petaluma who comes by here periodically with his laptop in his lap because he's a Windows developer to enlist us to help stop Wi-Fi in the public schools. And I said, you got the wrong person for that. Jason Ponton, who edits the MIT editorial review, I found out about this article on Facebook when he put a link to it on his Facebook and wrote something that I thought was really good on all of this. My own experience as a science and technology editor is that conspiracy theories are impervious to evidence. People who like these sorts of theories are the kinds of people who like these theories. Conspiracy theories satisfy a deep need to think history is rational, even if the reasons are occluded. People who like conspiracy theories need to self-identify as savvy souls who can see through the propaganda that includes the sight of sheeple. Showing people why they're wrong about a theory just makes them dig in deeper. They get angry. In the end, conspiracy theories collapse like drunkards fall apart, slowly, then all at once. Later, we all pretend that a large number of Americans never actually believed X or supported Y because national life must go on. And it's intolerable to our civic religion of democratic anti-elitism to admit that half of us don't know our butts from the hole in the ground. And then he links to this New York Times story about chemtrails. Wow. Okay. I thought that was a good way to put that.
Thing is, they're connected to things that actually happen. You know,
right.
We do spray chemicals from the air because that's how we do crop dusting. But that's done with small planes that are very low to the ground because otherwise...
No, every conspiracy theory is somewhat believable.
There are also people who have called for atmospheric geoengineering to end global warming and things like that.
It's not out of the realm of the
possible. You can find papers from sensible scientists who will say, could we fix global warming by filling the atmosphere with dust or something like that? And so there's a series of things you can join the dots to, but then you decide every streak of cloud in the sky is a chemtrail from a plane that's trying to kill you. And that's when it gets a bit weird.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, I think y'all are all wonderful.
Is it time to go?
It's time for me to go. All right. Guys can keep talking.
No, we should wrap her up. You warned me. So we're going to let Stacey go. I will read an ad and then we'll come back with our picks of the week. Stacey, thank you so much. Have fun at IDF. Have a great conversation with your daughter. Are you going to use Duo?
Oh no, we're going to use Hangouts. We have a sticker sharing relationship on Hangouts that we just keep going.
That's so sweet. Oh my goodness!
All right. Well, sayonara. Thanks, it's also good. I don't have anything for you this week, so
Stacey on IoT. You always have something for us. You're a brilliant brain. Stacey on IoT.com at Giga Stacey on Twitter if you still want to use that. Thank you, Stacey.
Thanks. Bye, y'all.
Take care. Our show today brought to you by something Stacey, I'm sure, would endorse and support. I think she even has one, the Ring Video Doorbell. I have one right here. Well, actually, I have one on my door. I think maybe I put it on my door. The Ring Video Doorbell lets you see and talk to and hear somebody at your front door, whether they're ringing the doorbell or just moving around out front. It is awesome. It replaces your wired or unwired doorbell with a very nice chime that will ring inside your house. But it will also let you answer your doorbell using your smartphone or tablet wherever you are anywhere in the world. Yes, it's internet connected. And now Ring has a great deal on their security bundle kit. If you go to ring.com/twig, you could save a significant amount on a variety of Ring Video doorbell kits, whether it's just the basic Ring. And what is that thing next to the Ring? I don't know what that is. I'm going to have to look at that now. This is something new, it looks like. They also have a bundle kit that has the Ring and the stick-up cam, which is awesome. That gives you the stick-up cam. It gives you a camera kind of much like the Ring Video Doorbell. It's a solar security sign. Oh, that's nice. So you can say protected by Ring. You'll love it. You can also get with one of their bundles, you get the solar panel. Which allows your stick-up cam to work without ever being wired. Love that. And the chime, which plugs into any standard power outlet and works with your Ring Video Doorbell. so that you know you have a visitor, even if your phone is in the other room. Ring is great, especially summertime when bad guys often will come to your door, especially while you're at work or on vacation, to see if anybody's home. If no one answers the doorbell, they're going to go around back and break in. But see, you'll always answer the doorbell, even if you're in Paris or London or Stockholm. There are two kinds of Ring video doorbells. There's the Ring that I have, which has the battery, year-long battery. But if you don't need a battery, if you're using a wired doorbell, get the Ring Video Doorbell Pro. It's a lighter, slimmer. It also has an HD camera. Well, both are HD, but it has a 1080p camera. Really great picture. I just saw one for the first time the other day. And you're going to get lots off by getting one of the Ring of Security bundle kits. So check them all out at ring.com/twig. I always know who's coming and going at my house, even if they don't ring the doorbell, thanks to my Ring video doorbell. I love this now. They'll sell you a little, one of those little security signs to put out front. Oh, it's solar too. Oh, that's cool. That's nice. Ring.com/twig. We thank them for their support of This Week in Google. Well, we lost Stacy, but that doesn't mean we get to go home yet because it's time for our picks of the week. Let's start with you, Kevin. I'm sure you have a few things you'd like to promote with the Indie Web.
Well, the big one coming up is Indie Web Camp New York, which is the 27th and 28th of August. And I want to encourage Jeff to come along and send his journalism students along as well. Yes. The link's 2016.indieweb.org/NYC2. Sign up there. There's space for, I think, 20 or 30 people to come along. And we should be live streaming it as well. But basically, the Indie Web Camp is like the two-day event where we get together to talk about building our own websites, spend the first day is initial like show and tell of what you've made and discussions. The Sunday is a sort of hacking day, and then it ends with a demo of things we've built over the weekend. And we've done lots of these in different cities. We've already done one in New York this year, and that one was snowed out because it was done during the blizzard. Oh. So that shouldn't happen this time around.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
But that's coming up. Plus, we also obviously have the Homebrew website clubs in lots of cities. Next Wednesday, including San Francisco, Portland, Brighton, and places in Germany and Sweden as well, I think. I can't remember exactly which ones are happening this week. And then the other news was the thing I mentioned briefly in the Social Web Working Group, which is that MicroPub is now candidate recommendation, which is the last stage before it becomes a full publication, which means this is a really good time to test out MicroPub with your stuff. So MicroPub is the specification that lets you remote post to another site. So you basically authorize somebody to post on your website, and then that gets sent out. And we've built this to connect things together in different indie websites. There's also a site called silo.pub that will connect to sites like WordPress and Blogger and Tumblr and Twitter, so that you can post to those using this protocol as well. So it's a strong protocol for letting you publish from one site to another. We've got a set of implementations, and it's in CI, it's a really good time for you to test against it and try things out.
Very nice. Very nice. Jeff Jarvis, your tip of the week.
Oh, let me see here. I don't know if you want to show this or not. You may not want to because it's political.
Oh, go ahead.
The video that has been going all around the Twitter in the last couple hours is the Says Who video. Have you seen this?
No.
So Trump's lawyer is on CNN, and the correspondent says, well, you're behind, and you complain.
All right, well, let me ask you about this. So you say it's not a shakeup, but you guys are down. And it makes
says
sense
who?
That there would...
says who?
Says polls.
Who? Says all the polls.
Most of them. All of them?
That says who?
Polls. I just told you. I answered the question.
That's one way to prove the truth.
Which polls?
All of them.
All of them.
And your question is?
Okay, so my question is...
That's enough.
I don't think it is really surprising when...
Says who?
That solves it. Says who meme. The meme will be all around.
Says who. Get ready. You're going to see it everywhere. Says who?
So a couple other Trump moments without adding in political analysis. There was an analysis of his
tweets. I loved this one. I thought that was really interesting. They did a syntactic analysis.
Well, not no. It was a platform analysis.
And an emotion analysis as well.
That's right.
It's better.
Yeah.
So
the over-the-top wacky tweets come from Android, and they come from Trump's own phone. The other tweets come from iOS or the web client. And so, for example, the last 24 hours, I think that actually Donald Trump has been locked up somewhere. And his phone.
You bet he has.
24 hours, there's been no
Mike Pence
Android
said, Donald,
tweet.
Come here for a second. I have a fabulous tostada you're going to love. And and then they took his phone.
So if you look at the tweets and look at the source, if it comes from Android, that means it's Donald. That means it's a little bit, shall we say, more passionate.
This is actually a really good example of data analysis, and
it really is
that we were talking about. And what you know, if you just you know, everybody knows that politicians and celebrities and many others have people tweeting for them. The question is, you know, it seems like Donald tweets for himself. It turns out he also has people tweeting for him, and it's actually fairly easy to figure out which of Mr. Trump's tweets are his and which are from his team. And this data analysis, even down to which words are most likely to be from Android, which from iPhone. The Android iPhone thing made it kind of easy, right?
It did, but then backed up the data analysis to show that there were two different voices.
Yeah, and also there was a time analysis, and it's really interesting.
It has been 24 hours with no Android tweets.
Uh-uh.
I checked before we got on the show.
Uh-uh.
And lots and lots of Facebook, but the Facebook has the same, you know, milquetoasty voice as the iOS tweets.
Very interesting.
So there's also another study that Stately did of Trump searches by state.
Like other people searching?
Yes. What people search on. And where is it here?
Are they Trump? So, I don't understand.
What are people searching for about Trump?
Trump-related things.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So... Trump rally. What happens if Trump wins? California's where to move if Trump wins.
Oh, yeah, I love it. In the state of Washington, Trump voodoo doll is the number one Trump-related search. However, in the Keystone State, it's how to build a wall. In Florida, it's the best words. Louisiana, it's Obama birth certificate. It's in Texas. Contrast Texas to California. In California, where to move if Trump wins. In Texas, what happens if Trump wins. And, of course, in Hawaii, it's Miss Teen USA. And apparently in Alaska, nothing.
Nothing.
Nobody
wants to know. They figure they're safe. They'll just be part of Russia.
No.
Trump, with his good relationship with Putin, he's probably going to give it back to Russia.
That's pretty
funny. And
that'll
be
fine. That is pretty funny. Wow. Yeah. I don't know how a stately...
methodology maybe a little
what
suspect,
was
but it's
a
fun.
Trump tweet. You know, is Taco Bowl really a Trump treat?
They came up with a long list and then looked at it state by state. So it's not the best scientific methodology, but I enjoyed it. So
mine is a little more tech focused. In October 1991, Linus Torvalds released Linux to the world. Less than 2 years later, a gentleman now deceased in a very sad story, Ian Murdoch, created Debian. The Ian was his name. Debbie was the name of his wife. Yesterday was the 33rd birthday. 33rd? Yeah. Is that right? Can that possibly be right? 23rd birthday of Debian. Debian Day celebrated each year. Debian is unfortunately a little bit eclipsed by Ubuntu, which is really a derivative of Debian. But if you've been thinking about Linux, I love Debian. Debian.org. It is not supported as Ubuntu is by a company, but is fully community supported. It is, as I said, the basis for not only Ubuntu, but a great many Linux distributions. Why not use the source material? It's really great. And something I got to say is it's so easy now to install Linux. You install Debian, it's going to recognize almost all of your hardware out of the box. Linux has made huge strides in PC hardware compatibility. And since, frankly... most of the time, all you really need to use is a browser, and Chrome and Chromium are available, of course, on Linux. You're not even sacrificing anything and gaining a whole lot, including nobody spying on you, no advertising, no compelled forced upgrades, just a rock-solid operating system that's actually pretty fun to use. So happy birthday. Happy 23rd birthday.
That's kind of sweet.
Yeah. It's a nice story, really. Debian is a great operating system. It's free. It's completely free, and it's all community supported. I imagine there are a few people at IndieWeb Camp who use Debian.
I should think so.
Yeah. It's kind of the IndieWeb Camp of operating systems. Hey, thanks so much to Stacey Higginbotham once again. Sorry we had to let her go, but she's always welcome. She'll be back next week. Our first show from the new Brick House, I'm sorry, East Side Studio. We're calling it the East Side.
I was wondering, you're changing the name.
Well, it's not going to be bricks. All brick anymore, for one thing. And we thought we should give it a new name. The this studio is on the west side of Petaluma. The new studio will be on northeast side. And we're moving. On Sunday, our very first show.
So when you get off...
Plus, there's a theme song.
When you get off the freeway, is it over on that side of town?
It's on the last exit in Petaluma, the Petaluma North exit, it's mm-hmm. right there. It's very easy to get to.
Oh.
So you'll go through.
Oh, so that's why you are at the brewery, right. The brewery.
Right next
there,
to Lagunitas, yes.
Yeah.
IHOP, we got an Applebee's, we got a Burger King, we got a Jack in the Box, and we got a
Lagunitas. We're moving to America.
We're moving to America.
You're moving on
America.
Down. Yeah.
We're going to make America.
No antique shops there.
Yep. No, as a matter of fact, that's another reason to go there, and lots of parking. that's where we'll be next week.
How far away is that from your home?
Just as close. Our home is equidistant to the two studios.
Good.
So that's nice. Yeah, that's really nice. Kevin Marks is at kevinmarks.com. He's also IndieWebCamp. Make sure you go to IndieWebCamp.org to keep up on what's going on with the move to keep the web free, open, and ours.
Exactly.
Unless you're AOL and Verizon, in which case it's theirs. Not there. Never mind. It's too complicated. Jeff Jarvis, professor of journalism at the City University of New York, author of What Would Google Do? Public Parts, Gutenberg the Geek, Geeks Bearing Gifts. He's also on buzzmachine.com. That's where he blogs and often writes on Medium as well.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, both of you. Really good show.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And, always fun.
It's going to look a little different next time. It won't be quite as nice and polished. Eventually, it'll look very similar. One of the reasons there's a gap behind me now is we actually took that out, mm-hmm. that wall out.
You have how many settings? How many?
One fewer. So we'll have four sets plus my studio, so five total.
Okay.
Yeah. So one fewer. We're only losing one set.
That tall thing.
Studio. Yeah, the tall one. Exactly.
Yeah, which you never use.
Sky
right?
booth. Yeah, we know. It seemed like a good idea. Yeah. We got the living room, we got the round table, we got the news set, we got the radio corner, and my office is going to be identical. My office will be indistinguishable.
Wow.
So, yeah. Thank you all for being here. We'll see you next time.